yourself, little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan, 'cause everyone's lost chin deep in the sand. And what they're trying to sell to you, you shouldn't be buying. Think for yourself, little girl. Don't let them tell you how to run your world, 'cause everyone's the same, choking back that nervous hurl. And if they tell you they ain't, well, they're just lying. Yeah, they're just lying.
Well, a very hearty welcome to a show on KMUD called Thinking Clearly. I'm Bob Frelick.
I'm Julia Minton.
And I do want to point out that I love that tune, Thinking Clearly. And now we have the permission of the tune's author.
Who is?
And who also performs that tune and who owns the record company that that tune is out on. And it's George Harrab. And he's a wonderful musician and a skeptic and a critical thinker. And
well,
I hope to have him on the show sometime.
I'm looking forward to that. It's so appropriate now on our 12th show. We can say it's our official theme.
That's right. Next month, we can have a birthday party.
That's right. And many thank yous to George Harrab for giving us permission for that. It's really kind of suits us.
Well, this is a show about, if this is the first time you've tuned in or if you've forgotten what we do here, this is a show about critical thinking and lots of topics related to that. And tonight's no exception to that. And you want to tell them how they can contact us and get information to us and interact with us, Julia?
Absolutely. You can stay up to date with us on Facebook. Just put in the search bar Thinking Clearly Radio, and Bob and I check that. We're real people and we love hearing from you.
We do. And we get comments that make us think and actually give us ideas for future shows, which is really great. And if you have somebody that maybe wants to hear this show and didn't get a chance to do it, or of course you wouldn't be listening if you missed the show, but or if you want to hear it again, you can go temporarily before we get our podcast up to speed. You can go to kmud.org and click on the archive button. First Thursday of every month, 7 to 8, Thinking Clearly.
That's right.
Well, what do you think? What are we going to talk about tonight?
We are going to talk about framing and narratives.
Framing and narratives. And you know what prompted that? Do you remember last month we had Dr. Stephen Novella, who's a clinical neurologist and professor at Yale University School of Medicine, among other things, founder and host of Skeptic's Guide for the Universe. He's got all kinds of credentials in critical thinking. And he was talking in response to a phone call that we got, and he was talking about an issue and that folks that are promoting that issue have a wonderful narrative with an evildoer, you know, he talked about, I'm not going to get into the specifics of it, but that just keyed something in my mind. And what that keyed in my mind is that's pretty powerful stuff, narratives, frames, and that kind of thing. And so that kind of spurred the topic for tonight.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically, we're going to describe the concepts of framing and narratives with the help from some audio clips from some experts that talk about it. And we're going to talk about how critical thinkers can recognize and take into account frames and narratives. We're also going to explore the beneficial use of frames and narratives, because they aren't just all bad. They're there to persuade us. They're there to sometimes manipulate us. But there's great uses of those.
Mm-hmm. Like many tools, it can be used for good or for bad. It itself, frames and narratives, are just what they are. They're benign until they're used.
And we're also going to ponder a question. I'm going to put that question out there. The question is the idea of whether critical thinkers, if you consider yourself a critical thinker, as we've described critical thinking and the process of critical thinking, on this show, and you put yourself in the camp of a person who considers yourself either a critical thinker or someone who's striving to do that mm-hmm. more.
That's me.
That's all of us. It's a work in progress. Then the question I want to throw out there is mm-hmm. The idea of frames and narratives, can we use that in our own communication as critical thinkers? And so you might think about it. Julie and I really have not rehearsed that.
We really haven't.
The answer to that question. And I don't know. I'm not decided on it.
Well, let's get into, you've posed us a question. Let's get into some of the meat of it. When you say framing, I assume you're not talking about the things you hang on the wall.
No, or the things that go around a picture, although that's a pretty good mm-hmm. analogy. A frame frames the picture, mm-hmm. right? That's the part you see. That's the part that's highlighted. And so that kind of gives you an idea. So framing really will take a step back and talk about first talk about framing as it comes from cognitive science. Mm-hmm. That's kind of a theoretical way of viewing framing. And then we'll get into how that concept is actually used in communication and other areas. But framing, and we're going to hear a clip in a moment, but frame has two elements. And those elements are, first, what objects are in the frame. You know, what do we see? What's mm-hmm. there? And the second is a scenario. What's happening in the frame? And these are represented by areas in our brain. And we think and perceive the environment around us in frames because we can't take everything in mm-hmm. all at once. Just think of how confusing that would be. So framing is a way of selecting. It's a very natural process. And so we're going to get into the first clip. And this is a clip that I edited out from Professor George Lakoff. And he's a cognitive linguist, and he's retired now from UC Berkeley. A lot of people know him from the book Moral Politics, which uses the ideas of frames and metaphors, mainly to explain the differences between liberals and conservatives in politics. He has developed a lot of ideas around that, and people might be familiar with his work. In fact, we probably will do something on Lakoff in a future show. But let's hear him. Do you have anything to add to that?
No, I'm looking forward to this clip.
Okay, let's start out, and we'll hear George Lakoff. Remember again, this is kind of the cognitive science definition or description of a frame.
Framing is the most ordinary thing you do. You think in terms of structured called frames, and let me tell you just a bit about it. The work on this was done in the mid-1970s. 1974, frame analysis by Irving Goffman came out. 1975, the linguistic work of Charles Fillmore. Goffman looked at institutions and studied them by actually working in them. He worked in an insane asylum and in Las Vegas as a croupier in order to study them. What he discovered was this. Every institution is structured by a frame, and it has two parts. Roles or frame elements. For example, take a hospital. You have doctors, patients, nurses, orderlies, receptionists, instruments like scalpels, places like operating rooms. Those are the frame elements. Then there are scenarios. What happens in this frame? So you know that surgeons operate on patients with scalpels in operating rooms, right? And lots of other things happen in the frame. So that is what a frame is. And you know the boundaries. For example, you walk into the hospital to visit a friend. You go to the reception desk. There's a doctor lying there. They hand you a scalpel, and they say, you're operating on this doctor. It doesn't fit the frame. And you know it doesn't. Okay? That is called breaking the frame. It's outside of it. You think in terms of those frames, and they are physically realized in the neural circuitry of your brain. Other great result about frames is Charles Fillmore's. He's a member of the linguistics department, now retired, one of the great linguists in the world. He figured out that every word in every language is defined relative to a frame. Every word, like surgeon or scalpel or menu for a restaurant and so on. you understand it in terms of a structure like that. So this is normal. Frames are the most normal things in the world, and we'll see in a minute that they are thoroughly political.
Well, we won't see that they're thoroughly political until some future show, because we're just going to confine ourselves tonight to describing frames and narratives, how they're used in all kinds of different settings. And basically, when you think of frames, Julia, where do you think of? You probably don't think of necessarily the theoretical cognitive science that Lakoff just talked about. Where do you think mm-hmm. of them?
I do. I think of photography, because it is a matter of picking an object, zooming in, wanting to fit something in a way that it contextually makes sense, that is balanced. For instance, if I were to take a picture of you here, I would focus in on you with your headphones and your microphone, but I would lose all that's around us, the studio that makes radio right now, that goes to an antenna that transmits the radio signal to four different signals. And all that context kind of gets lost. Instead, I do think of, because I like photography, of how you frame something can convey a message. It can, you can take something and make it look malevolent, or you can make it look serene and heavenly. You can make it look surreal, unreal, just by how you frame it, maybe a little bit of light trickery.
So I never thought of that in terms of photography. But you're right on with that. And just think of the power that that gives the person who is controlling the frame. And that's what we're going to talk about tonight. Generally, when people are talking about frames, they're talking about communication. And so a lot of work has been done on that, although it pops up in psychology and sociology, decision-making, mass media, various different disciplines, and has been much studied. It's a very rich topic. Unlike a lot of the things we talk about on this show, they seem superficial at first, and the more you get into them, the more you realize that people have been studying these for years in excruciating detail. So it's always kind of a balance on this show to give enough detail and background so that people are kind of getting the big picture and getting the idea of what we're talking about and definitions and that kind of thing, but not go into excruciating detail to the point that it gets either boring or confusing.
We can point you in directions so you can cure your own insomnia.
Exactly. So we're going to talk about that tonight. And by the way, we'll open the phone lines around 735, 740, something like that, for you to weigh in on tonight's topic. So going on a bit, framing theory, if you look that up in Wiki, you'll see the sentence in there saying, framing is the process by which a communication source, such as a news organization, defines and constructs a political issue or public controversy. And then I ran across some work from a communications researcher whose name was Jim Kuipers, and he relates framing to rhetoric. And he says that frames are powerful rhetorical entities that induce us to filter our perceptions of the world in particular ways, just like you talked about, Julia, with photography, essentially making some aspects of our multidimensional reality more noticeable than other aspects. So I think if you're getting the idea, the sort of general idea of what a frame is, you could, and you wanted to persuade someone of something, you could begin to see the power in how you would frame your message.
Yeah, absolutely. Because when you're trying to convey a concept, like you said, we can't get into all the, we only have an hour here. We can't get into every single little nitty bitty detail that comprises the message we're trying to send. So naturally, one way or another, we have to pick out the information to in order to share it with you. And we want to do it in a comprehensive way. So we pick our frames and how we choose to frame something for the purpose of conveying information to you.
Just a couple more details here, because Kuiper talks, has looked at, spent years looking at the whole idea of framing and analyzed what is actually happening in frame when people frame messages, for example. And they do it in different ways. One way of doing it is to compare the idea being communicated to something else. using metaphors, analogies, or you can contrast it by saying what is actually missing. Lots of times people use very powerful cultural symbols, slogans, and various other ways. And what we're attempting to make a case for tonight is how important it is to learn to recognize frames and become aware of how they might influence you on a particular issue, because mm-hmm. a lot of this is kind of subliminal. We don't really realize it. And what I'm beginning to be aware of is that it's easier for us to pick up frames that are occurring with ideas that we don't agree with mm-hmm. than it is ideas we agree with that we tend to endorse. But there's framing that is occurring both in those ideas that we tend to agree with that sometimes might mask a deeper way of thinking about that issue. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later.
Yes, certainly.
Should I give this example? It's a little bit of reading, but it's from the course material of Professor Rex Mitchell from Cal State Northridge. Professor Mitchell gives three different frames for the same political situation, and that situation is the ongoing conflict between Israel and the Palestinians. So I'm going to read first the Israeli frame. It goes something like this. This is a land settled by our ancestors thousands of years ago under direction from God, resettled by our parents over half a century ago, and developed and improved by our people since. This land is vital to the protection of our people from the criminal terrorist acts and the Palestinians, who the Palestinian leaders have refused to control. We must never give up one inch of this land. Okay.
That's one perspective.
Okay, you want to give the Palestinian perspective?
Yeah, so the other side would be the Palestinian perspective. The Palestinian frame of the same situation is this is land that has been inhabited by our ancestors for thousands of years. This land is vital to the development of a viable Palestinian homeland, which should be an independent Palestinian state. There can be no peace until we regain our rightful possession of this land.
And we're just giving these as examples and encouraging you to become aware of the framing that's actually taking place in your real life communication. Now, we might be able to then convert that into sort of a more neutral frame. And that would go something like this. This is a very special land, characterized by thousands of years of history involving ancestors of you both. It has historical, religious, and political importance for each of you, and both have a sincere desire to find a solution to the conflict that stops the bloodshed and provides a basis for your peoples to live in peace. So those frames give a different picture for each perspective, and very kind of typical example of framing.
Especially we see it in politics. It's extremely common in things that are politically controversial. It is a good example because it's the same situation, just framed from different perspectives. And you can kind of, you know, I know I can kind of put myself in each position and sympathize from that perspective. But really it's the totality of all those frames, if you will, and then some that make up the reality of it.
Mm-hmm. You know, I like the, have you ever read the magazine The Week?
Yes.
Do you like that?
It's interesting. It's short.
Mm-hmm.
it's good for your morning coffee.
Yeah. What I like about The Week is, first of all, I can catch up on the news real quick. You know, mm-hmm. because it just synopsizes the issues. But what it does is it has a synopsis, a kind of overview of what the issue is, which is kind of neutrally worded.
Mm-hmm.
And then the article will look at different sources that have a different frame, a different way of viewing mm-hmm. it. And it compares them and contrasts them and kind of pits one against the other. And that's lovely. I love that because it gives you, at a glance, it gives you a glimpse of how different perspectives are framing the issues.
Mm-hmm.
And
both inform the bigger picture.
Exactly. Exactly. I was going to read that, an example of that, but I think I'm going to leave that out. So the other thing I wanted to mention is that there are key words in our communication. Listen for these words. Have you ever heard anybody talking about an issue and then they say, the issue is?
Yeah, I say that.
Do you?
Yeah.
The issue is. I had a boss at one time, and we'd go to meetings, and she would start out most of the meetings anytime something controversial came up. She would start the sentence with, the issue is.
Mm.
And then she would frame the issue. So in other words, she had complete control over how she was viewing the issue and putting it out there is, this is the way you should view the issue.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And as ornery as I can be sometimes, I would always raise my hand and say, well, or the issue might be. Pandemonium then, so sometimes that's good, and sometimes it just prolongs the agony.
It does sound like a way to control the discussion, to keep
subtly.
It
subtly, because people, mm-hmm, a lot of people don't realize that when somebody says the issue is, they're attempting to control the way you're looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to all these other ways of looking at it. So that's a key word, something to listen for. So let's move on to...
And again, I'm just going to add that these aren't terrible things. They're just things to keep an eye out for and to take into consideration if you're having a discussion, debate with somebody, in how you process that information. That's what rhetoric is. It's the way we convey information.
Yeah, and rhetoric tends to be rhetoric and also, as we're talking about frames and narratives, tend to be ways of making the message more powerful, and that can have its good points, but it can also be a way of controlling, manipulating,
mm-hmm, and sometimes it's needed. And sometimes it's being used against you.
Yeah. Sometimes it can be used to motivate, and sometimes it can be used to persuade or obscure certain aspects of an issue. Let's move to narrative. Narrative is just, in general, a spoken or written account of connected events, right?
It's a story.
It's a story.
It has a beginning, a middle, an end.
Exactly. And again, that's another topic that there's been so much work analyzing narratives and all this kind of stuff. We're not going to go into that kind of detail here. We're going to look at narratives designed to influence and persuade. There's an interesting article that I came across in the Harvard Business Review. It says, effective storytelling can serve anyone in leadership who seeks to persuade others to his or her point of view. Opinion-based rhetoric is often more polarizing than persuasive, while statistics often go in one ear and out the other. But a careful blending of rhetoric and facts woven into the right story can change minds. So the message becomes embedded in the story.
Mm-hmm. Very true.
And we have a clip that illustrates this. And this clip is of our dear President Trump. And it was it's an example of the use of narratives. Now, presidents use this all the time. They bring someone into the audience. They tell a story about them, something that happened in their lives, and use it to illustrate a point. It's very powerful because you can see there's a real person involved, a real issue, a real situation, and you've got the credibility of that person being right there who is endorsing that. You're not making that up. It's true. And so it's used a lot in politics. Well, this is an example of the use of narrative from President Trump's joint session of Congress that he delivered back in February 28th of this year. And this was in his attempt to boost support for his aggressive immigration policy. So let's take a listen to President Trump.
I have ordered the Department of Homeland Security to create an office to serve American victims. The office is called VOICE, victims of immigration crime engagement. We are providing a voice to those who have been ignored by our media and silenced by special interests. Joining us in the audience tonight are four very brave Americans whose government failed them. Their names are Jamil Shaw, Susan Oliver, Jenna Oliver, and Jessica Davis. Jamil's 17-year-old son was viciously murdered by an illegal immigrant gang member who had just been released from prison. Jamil Shaw Jr. was an incredible young man with unlimited potential who was getting ready to go to college where he would have excelled as a great college quarterback. But he never got the chance. His father, who is in the audience tonight, has become a very good friend of mine. Jamil, thank you. Thank you. Also with us are Susan Oliver and Jessica Davis. Their husbands, Deputy Sheriff Danny Oliver and Detective Michael Davis, were slain in the line of duty in California. They were pillars of their community. These brave men were viciously gunned down by an illegal immigrant with a criminal record and two prior deportations, should have never been in our country. Sitting with Susan is her daughter, Jenna. Jenna, I want you to know that your father was a hero and that tonight you have the love of an entire country supporting you and praying for you. To Jamil, Jenna, Susan, and Jessica, I want you to know that we will never stop fighting for justice. Your loved ones will never, ever be forgotten. We will always honor their memory.
Any comments about that, Julia?
Well, I was actually just thinking about one of my favorite authors, David Foster Wallace, once said in an interview that he really enjoys fictional writing because it's your opportunity to experience the world from somebody else's point of view for a change. Because we're always just stuck behind our own eyes. We're stuck in our own reality. But reading fiction is, you know, or engaging in narrative is a way for us to truly put ourselves in somebody else's shoes and to see the world from somebody else's eyes. And I think that's part of the power that narrative evokes in us, is that we can honestly put ourselves, suspension of disbelief, and kind of put ourselves in somebody else's place for just a moment. And an example like that of President Trump talking about people who have sacrificed themselves for our country, and also fear of malevolence puts us in that place. It engages us as a sort of, that's a reality we experience in that moment. And it takes us out of where we are, whether we're sitting on our couch watching the president talk or in our car driving, listening on the radio. It puts us there.
So narratives and frames can be very powerful tools to use to persuade us. Mm-hmm. And so let's bring this back now to critical thinking. Mm-hmm. Because remember, I know you remember, Julia, but folks out there, remember that critical thinking, what makes critical thinking different is that critical thinking is using logical reasoning based on a lot of evidence, a thorough survey
as much as you can get
of the evidence, and then you use logic to connect the evidence to a conclusion or a claim. Mm-hmm. And so it's evidence-based reasoning, basically. And so a narrative or framing is kind of antithetical to that in a way, because it's inviting us to accept a frame without evidence, but largely through emotional appeal. Now, you have a quizzical look on your face, so that usually means that Julia doesn't agree with me, but that's good.
Well, I wouldn't say it's emotional appeal is a factor, but I wouldn't say that is the core of it. I would frame it as a narrative delivers a pretty little package, all wrapped up just for you. And it's easily digestible. It has a beginning, a middle, an end. And it just lays it all out for you in a nice, clean way. But if you take a kind of earnest look at what it is to live as a human being on this planet, in this reality, there's virtually nothing that is in a tidy little box presented for you that makes perfect sense. In fact, I would go so far as to say anytime a pretty little box is delivered to you like that, that should be a skeptical moment. That should be a moment in which you say, wait a minute, but nothing else in my life makes this much clear sense. So why would this? Everything else is messy.
Yeah. So in thinking about this topic and what we can suggest to people who want to recognize narratives and frames in the messages that they receive, what they can do to first recognize that, we've talked somewhat about that, keywords, listening to emotional language, emotionally charged language, seeing what has possibly been left out of the frame that is also important and needs to be there to make a good judgment.
And that's what I would say is just because you notice that, again, this pretty little package is being delivered to you, doesn't mean that you should immediately discard it, but it's a moment to kind of unpackage it, maybe ask some more questions, wonder what has been left out that it's all clean and put together. So that might be an opportunity to, again, ask questions, inquire about more information to get a bigger perspective of it, unpackage it.
And I would go a little bit further and a little bit more structured in what I would recommend. I think that's a good start to recognize it, unpackage it. But what does that mean to unpackage it? And in thinking about this, and I want to get your opinion on it, Julia, the way I would unpackage it or suggest that folks who want to get more into critical thinking about issues, unpackage that nice, neat little frame or narrative package, is that you actually systematically look and listen to the message and replace the emotionally charged language with neutral language, just like we did in
previous. I disagree so much, I'm interrupting.
Okay. Well, let me just finish that part of it, and then we'll get into that. But to actually, it's called in logic, actually, it's called putting an argument in standard form. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the first things you want to recognize, is there really an argument there, or is it just an opinion? Because a lot of frames, narratives are really opinion. There's no evidence there. And I think it's important to, first of all, realize, is there evidence? Is it an argument? If it's an argument, then it's going to have evidence, which are called premises in logic. And then there's going to be a logical inference that leads you to a conclusion. So one way of dealing and unpackaging, maybe not the only way, but one way, is to actually replace the language and put it in what logicians call standard form, which is strip it away from its emotionally charged appeal and language, put it into and recognize, is there an argument? That's the first step. Mm-hmm. Secondly, if there is an argument, then write down what the evidence is. What are the premises and what's the conclusion? And that would be one way of unpackaging it. Now, go ahead.
Well,
enlighten me.
I was reacting to replace. So I see what you're saying, and I think it's important to understand what's the objective of the conversation you're having. Are you having a debate with somebody? Which again, we use debate, argument in a not a hostile way, in an informative exchange of ideas. you know, so that might be one possibility. Are you having a conversation with someone? There are appropriate times for people to make appealing arguments in which they want to persuade you. And there is a place for emotion when people are conveying their ideas and concepts. I think it's important to acknowledge that emotional appeals will not get you to truth, but it is, I think, a part of the human experience. So I hear what you're saying in a formal logic sort of way. If we really want to lay out a debate and we want to say, who's right, Julia or Bob, you know, yeah, we're going to want to resort to our formal logic, some sentential calculus. but here's where I object is saying replace words. I think it's better to ask questions and to inquire than to simply say, oh, Bob, when you said X, I know that you really meant Y.
And I'm not so much talking about when we're having a face-to-face conversation or discussion.
Sure.
I'm talking mostly when I'm talking about that kind of structured approach is something that you're getting in writing, you're seeing on the internet, that sort of thing. It's a way of a structured way of recognizing whether there is really evidence there, whether there really is an argument there. Mm-hmm. When would be some of those times when it's important to motivate that you might think about?
Well, certainly there are folks who have done their homework. They have evidence-based opinions, informed opinions, and they want to evoke change. I mean, that's the first thing that comes to mind. There are things in this world worth fighting for. Mm-hmm. Again, we're not an issue-oriented talk show, but, you know, climate change is on people's minds these days. There's a lot of things on people's minds that our progress. We want human progress. Mm-hmm. So in order to build those changes, movements, systematic change, it does require persuading people to get on board, to activate people to participate in those changes. And, you know, we talked recently about the March for Science. That was something that evoked quite a bit of debate as far as should scientists even be participating in politics? Should science be persuading people of anything? Because that's not really what science does. So I think I don't have a magic answer, but it's certainly one of those kind of the question we started with at the beginning of the show.
And we'll get to that in a moment. But I'm seeing a little bit of sort of resolution to maybe what were the different perspectives that we're coming to. And what I keyed in on is when you said, if you have already done the evidence-based work to analyze an idea, then there is a time, and those other folks that you want to motivate, that you want to encourage, that you want to persuade to actually get off their duff and do something about, I agree with you. Then we need those narratives and frames and emotionally charged. That wouldn't be the time to strip out the emotionally charged. But I think that too often people get into an issue before they have actually done the critical thinking to decide, are they marching for the right cause?
Well, I do have an opinion about everything, whether or not I've done my homework.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah, that's the part that I was. So before you need to do your homework and do your critical thinking before the march. And then once you've determined that this is worth marching for, I'm marching for the right thing that's going to meet the goals that I think are important and useful and helpful. And at that point, then rhetoric away, frame away, use narratives to get some solidarity built. So would that be a way of saying that we agree on that particular
I think
issue?
So, yeah. I think building narrative on top of a foundational wealth of accurate information is a really good way to go. And that is when, if you were engaging someone and you notice that there's a strong narrative going on in your communication, to ask questions, to inquire about that foundation that might be below the narrative, or it might not be. And that might also give prompt the person to do some of their background work so they can answer those questions more in the future. Narrative is something that we've been using since the beginning of time, really. We're kind of built in a way to have stories, a linear beginning, middle, end story. We don't start at the end and then go to the middle and go to the beginning. It doesn't work like that. We're storytellers by nature. We've been conveying information with stories since before we could write. And that is how we transmitted our knowledge bases to each other. So there's a lot of usefulness. It's, I think, an integral part of who we are as a human, and can also have therapeutic values. So it's not something, again, to be disregarded, but to be attuned to know when it... there's certainly, if you read a lot of news articles like I do, there's a big difference between a kind of straight, dry reporting. These are the facts. So-and-so was there at X. And then a more flourish of, you know, I'm not coming up with the right word right now, but a writing that grabs you more. Mm-hmm. And usually you will find, because it has a motivating framework and a interesting, sometimes emotionally appealing narrative.
So would it be fair to say that there are appropriate times when critical thinking is going to meet our goals, and looking at kind of objectively at the evidence and using logic, and there are times when the narrative, the frame, is the way to go, in terms of motivating us, building solidarity, maybe appreciating something in a way that we didn't appreciate it before?
I would say so, yeah. Much like photography, it's good to understand the environment before you zoom in and you take that picture.
Okay. And as you pointed out, framing and storytelling is used in therapy. In psychotherapy, rational emotive therapy with Albert Ellis, that was one of the first therapies to actually get people to challenge their irrational thoughts, mm-hmm. and to change those. Cognitive restructuring, restoring is mm-hmm. another kind of therapeutic technique. The use of metaphors and mm-hmm. storytelling in psychotherapy is very, very powerful.
Yeah, rewriting your own narrative. We're impressed upon in our developmental, in our development as children, and a lot of those that programming kind of sticks with us, and we find certain narratives tend to reoccur throughout our life.
Yeah, so I think where we're coming to here is that it's an awareness of what your objective and what your goals are. In both receiving and communicating to others is mm-hmm. important. And an awareness of that is going to determine the kind of approach that you use.
Mm-hmm. And these are tools in which you can utilize to communicate. And I do think sometimes it's when these tools are used kind of unconsciously to persuade is another time to kind of be aware of them. But mm-hmm. I see you looking at the clock there. You think it's time to open the phone lines?
I think it is. You want to give the numbers?
Yeah, absolutely. You can give us a call here at KMUD by dialing 707-923-3911 or 1-800-KMUD-RAD if you're from out of the area. Give us a call here if you have a question, comment, thoughts. We'd love to hear from you.
Okay. And while we're waiting for the phones, do we have anyone on the phone yet? Okay. I want to, and the next clip I'm going to play is number four. And I want to talk about one way, because this is going to lead us into the question of how do we use this idea of framing and narratives in critical thinking, other than just to be aware that it can be used against us in a lot of ways. How do we actually, it's a powerful technique, both of them, and how do we use it in a way that will make critical thinking communication more powerful and more attractive? And a lot of folks are using it in science, because sometimes science can be dry. It can be something that's not too interesting to people. And so there's a whole movement to embed science in narrative and include a story that goes along with the mm-hmm. teaching of science. So I'd like to play a clip. This is from a guy whose name is Lee Gutkind, and he's a science writer and speaker and founder of the literary magazine Creative Nonfiction. So let's take a listen to number four.
True stories well told, and that's pretty much what creative nonfiction really is. In the 1960s and 1970s, people would say that the novel was king. Everybody was reading novels, but people are not reading that many big, serious literary novels anymore because the world has changed a great deal. There is so much more for us to learn and for us to know, genetics and computers and robots. So much for us to kind of take in, and that's kind of come be a part of this world. And that's one of the reasons that creative nonfiction has become so important, because creative nonfiction can teach people through story all kinds of things that they wouldn't necessarily want to know otherwise. I have written a book about robots. It's called Almost Human, Making Robots Think. But I tell stories that enable people to connect with robots. And I put real people in my stories because we connect with real people. We're people, and readers always want to know how other characters exist. So that's creative nonfiction. We have learned that people remember facts that are presented to them, many more facts, and for a much longer period of time when those facts are embedded inside a story. So if you want someone to know something and you tell them, you give them that information, they will lose a great deal of it. If, however, you embed that information in a real story with real people, they will remember it longer. Secondly, people are persuaded in a much more successful way, again, when that persuasive element with more facts, more information is presented in story. And thirdly, researchers have discovered that when we think about recreating our own life, our own histories, we think we remember our life stories in chapters, in stories. We don't just say, I was born here, I went to school here. We say, oh, the first thing I remember is my mom's nervous breakdown, or the day that I flunked freshman English, things like that. And so, again, the whole idea, if you want people to learn what it is you know, whether you're an engineer or a scientist, you try to do it in story. And so that's what creative nonfiction is all about.
Interesting.
Okay, good. Do we have a caller?
No.
Okay. We'll give those numbers one more time, 923-3911-1800-KMOD-RAD. And so, Collison, weigh in on frames, narratives, the power of using those, the little debate that Julia and I had a moment ago. What's your opinion on that? Anything that comes to mind in terms of the topic? Framing and narratives, since we're going to do this show, I've been listening, attuned to that. And Democracy Now!, maybe it was yesterday's Democracy Now!, they had a segment in there that they mentioned frames and narratives. It must have been 8 or 9 times in that 10-minute segment on Democracy Now! If you were at the local meeting with Congressman Huffman
last night,
I heard him use the term narratives and framing. By the way, narratives are not. If you say to someone that's your narrative, if I say that to you, I don't mean that in a negative way.
Mm-hmm.
Another way of saying that is this is the way you're looking at something.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't necessarily, narratives don't have to be not true. They don't have to be made up. They can be stories that are true. And this is just what we heard Lee Gutkind talking about. He doesn't make the stories up. He uses real stories to embed the science ideas in.
There's a number of people, too, who have talked about the therapeutic value of writing memoirs, revisiting your own life, because narrative and your working memory have a close relationship, and you revisit your own life. And it's sort of that Joseph Campbell concept of the hero's journey. When you go back and you write your memoir, you become your own hero in your own story. And again, they're true stories, but it's reframing your own personal narrative and your place in it. And it can, it is a little bit of voluntary delusion. But it's also, if it's somewhat grounded in facts, it has that foundation of what is true and earnest and integrity, then it can better inform you about who you are and how you go about your journey through your life.
The problem is sometimes that everyone who has an opinion, a strong opinion on something,
like
thinks
me?
They have integrity.
Like
most,
me?
Yeah. Most folks are not going to say, you know, I have a very strong opinion on that, so therefore I'm fine to frame and use narratives, the power of those, to persuade other people to believe my opinion and endorse my opinion. But it's a diabolical opinion. It's really, it's really going to screw everybody up. Everyone thinks that their ideas are ethical, are the way the world ought to be. I found it interesting in that that Democracy Now! Segment that I was talking about yesterday. The headline, I looked it up on Democracy Now! Website, and the headline is, "Private mercenary from Tiger Swan compares anti-Dakota Access Pipeline water protectors to jihadist insurgency." And I thought, you know, that is a good way of putting out there two different frames. Water protectors is a frame. Mm-hmm. That's a way of framing it. You see, water protectors are actually people that are going out with the idea of protecting the water. It's a positive thing. They're mm-hmm. not. They're not there. They're not just demonstrators trying to
or eco-terrorists.
Process. Yeah, or jihadist insurgents, you know. But it's dueling frames that were involved in that. And I heard Amy and her guest that she was interviewing must have said water protectors about 7 or 8 times. It's kind of like, okay, we're going to capture the moment here in terms of framing and using that term water protectors mm-hmm. to compensate for them being called insurgents.
Contrasting.
Yeah.
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 And it's a lot like that example we gave earlier of the Israel-Palestinian conflict. And then yet there is a third, one could attempt to kind of have a third frame, which would be somewhere in the middle, somewhere more neutral.
So the message I think that I'm hoping is the takeaway message from the show tonight is to be aware of what your goal is. Either if you're the communicator or you're receiving communication and information, what is your goal? Is your goal to get hyped up and motivated? Then go with the emotional message, the frames, the narratives, and right on, you know. If your goal is to think through an issue, we've got critical thinking and looking for evidence, arguing, using logic and support premises and that kind of thing. But I want to get a little bit more, and if we have some callers, we'll take the callers. If we don't have callers, we'll spend this time talking about this because I need to have a little bit of start on trying to figure out an answer to this question. And the question is, as critical thinkers, should we harness the power of framing a narrative in our communication? And if so, how would we do that? What would that look like?
What would that look like? Would it look like what we're doing here? Not quite. Not quite.
I'm not sure, because as critical thinkers, we would go out and we would give evidence. Mm-hmm. And we would use logical arguments to support a claim or a conclusion, right? But how would we embed narratives and frames into that to make our communication more powerful?
Well, in a sense, we are trying to persuade people to participate in critical thinking. We're here saying critical thinking is good and that we want other people to do it. And we don't really quite utilize narrative, but we do frame the importance of critical thinking in our lives.
Okay, I think we have a caller, so let's see what the caller has to say about this.
Hello.
Hello, caller.
You're on the air.
Yeah, I've been thinking, I've been worried a long time about the controversy about framing a world around secrecy, lies, hate, and war. And we've been doing that, it seems like, since the beginning. And how about time to have openness, truth, love, and peace? We'll try that, because they can't really coexist. The war seems to always take over.
Well, let me ask you this. You say truth, love, and peace. How do you determine what truth is? How do you personally, what process do you use personally to determine whether something is a manipulative frame or something that's actually true?
Well, sometimes it's not easy, but if it's logical, if it leads naturally, like secrecy leads to lies, because how can you keep a secret without lying? Okay? And then lies lead to hate, because when you find out somebody's been lying to you, it brings out the hate, and then the hate leads to war, which was the ultimate goal of the secret societies that started all this.
Okay. We have several claims there and not enough time to actually get into this and really, you know, dig a little bit deeper. But the claims are that secrecy leads to lies. Lies lead to hate. And what was the third one?
Hate leads to war.
Hate leads to war. What I'm hoping you'll think about is you've made three claims and to at some point figure out what the evidence is, because you're right, spot on. You say use evidence and logical reasoning. So
the
important thing,
you know the tree. By the fruit you know the tree, right?
Okay, but okay. We're right at the top of the hour, and next time you need to call a little bit sooner because we don't have time to get into that. But I do.
But thank you for calling.
Thank you for calling.
You're welcome.
And I hope that. That you got something out of tonight. Give us a email at tc@kmud.org or go to our Facebook page and let us know how this is you're processing all this. So another episode of Thinking Clearly, Julia. Right. Thank you very much.
That's right. 12th one under our hat.
Thank you, Eric.
Think for yourself, little man. Tells you that they have the plan, 'cause everyone's lost chin deep in the sand, and what they're trying to sell to you, you shouldn't be buying.
This program was produced in KMUD's Redway Studios and is provided courtesy of KMUD, People Powered Radio.